Thanks so much. I've kept the panelists on such a short leash because I do want to allow plenty of time for questions. I see Peter already has his hand up. Peter, you have the floor.
I'm going to perhaps surprisingly express agreement with a lot that Paul and Sally had to say, but in doing so, try to suggest that some of the focus of this meeting on the cost-benefit analysis is misplaced. I mean, what Paul said that strikes me exactly right is that OIRA's role is in assisting the president to help the agencies choose wisely among competing priorities. What Sally said that strikes me as exactly right is to make the analogy between OIRA's function in regard to rulemaking and OMB's function in regard to budget. But what one can say about both of those observations is that they are prospective in operation, that they occur at the stage of what in Executive Order 12866 is Section 4. And what we have not seen yet is any serious implementation by any administration of Section 4. What we have seen and what we have all been talking about and will probably continue to be talking about through this day is Section 6 and perhaps Section 7. And I wonder if that is not the fundamental mistake.
Sal, you want to?
I'm not sure it's the fundamental mistake. I take your point, and I think it is valid. And certainly Section 4 was written with the hope and expectation that it would have some substance. One of the realities is that the staff of OIRA sometimes gets swallowed by, or with alligators snipping at its ankles, as I think the expression. But it just the transaction work and the paperwork reduction work and the statistical policy work and all of the other work that is piled on it has been resulted in less focus than I think it should be on Section 4. The problem with actually moving aggressively on Section 4, however, Peter, is that many of the proposals at that stage are in such amorphous state with so little indication of what the agency is truly thinking. But my recommendation that OIRA get involved earlier, I think, is part and parcel of that same thing. Even when it's an amorphous state, if OIRA can be consulted. And there were a couple of true success stories that I thought the Clinton administration had by being involved early. And you will be pleased to know this was the seafood, I'm thinking of the FDA's seafood investigation and the HACCP rule. That came about through the Section 4 filing.
Paul, did you want to add a point?
I just wanted to agree with Peter, and I was glad when we were writing the report from the administrative law section to the president that that was included. I will say, too, there is precedent for this because there were a lot of the most important rulemakings in the last administration. OIRA did sit down with the agency very early to work on it. Clean Air Interstate rule and some of the other big air rulemakings were among them. You know, we couldn't get legislation through the Congress, so we worked with them to try to find a creative regulatory approach to address it. And I think you could take a small number of the very largest rulemakings that the president wants done in his time, and you could meet early with the agencies and signal those out for a kind of early involvement thing. I think one of the problems is the executive order is kind of written from a lawyer perspective, almost like OIRA's this court of appeals at the end of the pipeline. And it would be much better for OIRA in many cases, and this has to be done selectively because Sally's right, there's limited staff, but for the really blockbuster regulatory problems, work early with the agency to address those. And I think there's more precedent than you may realize for doing this based on what happened even in the last administration and also with the prompt letters.
And not about the general allocation of governmental effort, and it's the general allocation of governmental effort where the president has the greatest
say. Let Adam get his. Paul, do you want to quickly respond?
I would just say, let me just throw out climate change as a great example for what you're talking about. I think that
Okay. Adam?
Yeah, I think Peter's right that some of this should come even earlier than the individual rule level, but even at the individual rule level or programmatic level, I mean, Sally, I suffer from having only been in one part of the apparatus when I was there, but my memory of interagency cooperation in those days was more about one agency being told or exhorted sort of not to object to what another agency was doing, or two agencies being told, make sure you don't do something duplicative so that the regulated community will have to do something twice or have to do it less efficiently. And I think a lot of what agencies do, I do believe in this risk-risk trade-off issue. I think so many of the cases have been shams, but a lot of what agencies do is move their problems to other agencies or fail to deal with important government-wide problems in a concerted way. And I think a lot more early involvement by OIRA, and I think the FERC and Minerals Management is a great example of a problem that can't be solved without a facilitator of real early and true avoidance of these buck-passing operations.
Don Arbuckle in the back, I think, wanted to comment on this, or did you want to ask a different question, Don?
OIRA was not politically accountable. And I wonder if he and the panel could talk about what that means for an office in the office of the president. And if transparency is part of the a solution, what exactly, in addition to the current disclosure procedures, would you consider adequate transparency?
Oh boy, that tees it up for everybody, I think. Bill, do you want to start?
Well, first of all, it was CPR's comment, not really mine, but because I think that to a certain extent, Sally can correct me if I'm wrong, that she may have felt somewhat politically accountable. Certainly, they're confirmed by the Senate. They're at least under the Paperwork Reduction Act, they certainly are fully accountable. So I think it overstates it to say that they're not politically accountable. But for purposes of transparency, I think the GAO report made specific recommendations, and on my comments if I'd gotten to them. One is communications with branch chiefs, with desk officers, not just branch chiefs, and also outside communications outside the formal review period are two of the most important areas of increased transparency that could be done. Now, there are good arguments, I think, from an executive privilege type of perspective, why one might not want to do that. But the problem is that among most of the people in this room, OIRA is suspect. And the way to undo that suspicion, I think, is through transparency. So even though I don't think in other circumstances it would be called for, I think it's called for here.
Curtis?
Having watched 10 or 15 oversight hearings where OIRA administrators have testified, I can tell you that they are held accountable to a certain extent, and bleeding sometimes. The issue of transparency, I think, is one that's important, particularly in the context of suggestions that OIRA should be involved earlier in the process. When I was involved in a review of OIRA in 2003, we found many instances where OIRA informal reviews went on for months prior to formal submission of the documents, which sometimes took one day for the OIRA review process. So under the current construction of the transparency requirements, the agencies are only required to disclose what happened on that one day, not what happened in the 3 months prior to it when there were four or five drafts of the rules sent back and forth between OMB and the agency. So then the question is, and I had a very interesting conversation with John Graham about this in the wake of our recommendation that OIRA reviews should be transparent, even the informal suggestions that are the suggestions that were ultimately made that came during the period of informal review. And he said, do you really think we couldn't get someone else to make that recommendation for us, the Office of Science and Technology Policy within the EOP or the Department of Agriculture, for that matter? So the current requirement that OIRA, and specifically the agencies, disclose the changes that were made at OIRA's suggestion may actually be too narrow, even when construed to be including informal review. There may need to be a way to capture recommendations that are coming indirectly from OIRA. But you know, until that happens, OIRA is going to continue to be a black box, and they won't be able to be held accountable because no one will know what they did.
Rena, and then in back.
Just a couple of clarifications. First of all, CPR doesn't have a party line. We are 60 points of light, plus our wonderful staff. But the OMB comments were signed by the entire board. And just to clarify two things about them. One is we never said OIRA was not, the administrator was not politically accountable. We said that the experts at the agencies, the political appointees, were better people to spearhead these initiatives because they have political accountability and expertise. And second, we never said that it was OIRA's fault that the agencies are dysfunctional. That is the fault of many people leading. We can lead with Congress because we can all agree that we're distraught with Congress, I'm sure. But we did say that if the OIRA regulatory czar was looking for a mission, it would be very, very helpful for him to take a look at the cross-cutting issues among the agencies and see if there were some solutions to revive and strengthen them, because the health and safety ones, at least, are in pretty dysfunctional shape for a whole bunch of reasons. So Bill is one of our many points of light and shouldn't feel self-conscious at all.
Frank, and then I think the gentleman next to you had a question as well.
Well, I wanted to comment on the point that at least the last two speakers made about how the rest of OMB is reconciling budget requests, and so isn't OIRA doing that for regulations, just the same kind of task. And while there's a surface plausibility to it, it seems to me that that idea fails because budget dollars are fungible, and most of the regulatory benefits are not. Budget dollars spent on the military is a dollar not spent on healthcare and vice versa. A life saved by regulation of a coal mine in Wyoming versus a life saved by regulation of an oil refinery in Texas, there's no budget for we can only save a certain number of lives, so which one comes first? They only by rare coincidence will they even affect the same company. So one is reconciling something that's absolutely fungible and one is reconciling something that's not at all fungible. So what's the point?
Well, I think it's slightly different than that, and I'm sorry if I was unclear in making the comparison. What happens is that agencies do the best they can do, and they do quite well at that, whether it is in asking for their share of the pot, which can grow. We have something called deficits that enables it to exceed. It's not a zero-sum game all the time. Or whether it's a legislative proposals, we think we need more authority in this area to do A, B, or C, or whether it's a regulation. And what OMB does in its various components is to gather the input of other affected or interested agencies so that the broadest possible perspective can be provided, and the president, who is the head of the executive branch, has the benefit of the input of the different agencies. And it's not saying we don't want to save a life. It's whether there are intended or unintended consequences of proceeding in a particular path that will have ramifications that the president should be aware of as he pursues a regulation, a legislative proposal, or a budget. In that sense, the interagency coordination, which is one of the functions that is actually embraced in the CPR paper, is the same, not the subject matter of what it is. If I was unclear.
Sharper point on that question. When Jim Miller was head of OIRA and then director of OMB, He justified the placement of OIRA's tasks in OMB for one reason, which is that agencies need three things to operate. They need budgets, they need personnel, and they need legislative authority. They get them all through OMB. And therefore, the placement of OIRA in OMB gave essentially the administrator of OIRA the power to displace agency decisions. And so I
look, Jim Miller is Mr. Junkyard Dog, and I'm not going to defend.
No, but it raises the question, which I wanted to return to, about, and this is back to Curtis's question, if we were reconceptualizing the executive order, do we want to make it clearer that the final decision is for the agency and not for OIRA to make? Because if you look at Cass Sunstein's testimony on that particular question, once again, he punts. He says, well, we're going to do whatever the law tells us to do without any reference to what law he is looking at. And so once again, the question of decider or overseer is being teed up. And frankly, the idea that, well, OIRA's doing nothing different than other components of OMB in terms of legislation or budgetary requests brings back the concern that Jim Miller articulated when OIRA was first created.
I think that OIRA is well situated in OMB because it is physically and psychologically closer to the president than any other institution or agency. It has only one client, and that's the Office of the President, and it does not get caught up in some of the, quote, capture, close quote, by either industry or the enviros or the unions or big business or whatever that affects other agencies. I think it stands in a different position. Is it aided by the fact that there is also the B in OMB, and that when we speak from OIRA, the agencies may hear that this is OMB speaking? Sure. I'm not going to deny that
is. So you're a junkyard puppy, not a junkyard dog.
Bill. I love the little Labrador.
Curtis, Bill, one of
them. Yeah, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
I was just reacting to your comment that OIRA has only one client. I'm trying to remember, did the president create OIRA? No.
The president created the centralized review of regulations, because that is not a statutory function. That is a function of executive order. And so the function of OIRA to which I was addressing is yes, but it has other functions to which Congress created for it.
So perhaps Congress should turn its regulatory function into a statutory function and therefore control it better?
Well, I think that's a very good question that comes up, and the issue is whether it is better to set the charter for OIRA by executive order, where there is greater opportunity for flexibility, or through legislation, where once Congress has passed a bill, it tends not to revisit the subject. If you look at the Paperwork Reduction Act, I don't think that's a great model, because I don't think either the goals or the processes make sense. Whereas I think the executive order can better reflect the predilections and preferences of individual preferences. I didn't agree with 13422, the Bush executive order, but it sure did reflect the preferences of the then duly elected President of the United States. And I'm not sure that that's a bad thing.
I'll agree with Curtis here and disagree with Sally.
I wasn't taking the position.
No, I think on important issues like this, Congress has every right to be involved in that. And I think if Congress wanted to legislate in that area, I think that's appropriate.
Bill.
I think Cass Sunstein should have been more forthcoming in saying, as a formal matter, it is absolutely clear that the head of the agency, rather than the head of OIRA, has the authority under the statutes and makes the decision. But that simply begs the question of when OIRA says to the administrator of EPA, the president thinks that you're not doing what the law says, what happens at that point? Right? As a formal matter, certainly the administrator can sign the regulation. We all know that. But I just think it begs the question to ask it that way.
Yes, David.
Just think it'll be over. A couple of things. I think the suggestion, you've heard some panelists saying, well, OMB review is always anti-regulatory, and one of the longstanding OMB employees said that on the first panel. And then you hear other panelists saying, well, there's all this history of support for regulation. And I've studied this question, and I have to say the prompt letters under the Bush administration were all about affirming things that the agencies were already planning to do, or pushing measures that weren't regulatory, that were really information. There really isn't a single case in those prompt letters of trying to prompt the agency to broaden its regulatory agenda. I think the lead case is the only case where I could find where you could say that the OMB actually played a role in strengthening regulation. I think there are cases in the Bush administration where they approved and supported what the agency wanted to do, but other than lead, I couldn't find a single instance of under any administration of OIRA doing anything to make regulation stronger. And I think that the role of OMB has been, I guess from the inside, you know, there must be some subtle differences between administrations. But on a broader perspective, it looks remarkably similar in that OMB is always questioning whether regulation can be weaker, I think, as Mr. Arbuckle said. And I have some question about Bill Funk's characterization of what, about the question of what is the institutional role. Is OIRA about faithfully executing the law, helping the president faithfully executing the law? And I think there are two components to that. One is OIRA faithfully executing the law or actually fairly oblivious about the law and interfering with its execution in some way, with its faithful execution in one way? And the second question is, in what sense is OIRA acting on behalf of the president? And to my knowledge, the number of cases in which the president actually was involved in any of his decisions are small. They tend to come up when, on a very big rule, there's an unresolvable dispute between OIRA and the agency. But instead, what OIRA is doing is acting on the policy established in the executive order, which, under Reagan at least, was to remove burdens from the agency, and something like that spirit is in the order even today. So it's sort of a bunch of people who think they're acting on behalf of the president, but without consulting the president. And I guess I'll say I'm not a Unitarian on this.
I should have known better to call a law professor for the last question. Because we're almost out of time, I'd like to ask each panelist to respond to David's very carefully tailored question in about 1 minute each, please.
Well, let's talk afterwards about example where OIRA is pro-regulation. I don't have enough time to answer you now. On the second issue of the OIRA working on behalf of the president, kind of reminds me when Sally said she felt very accountable. You know, she's right across the street from the president when she's sitting at her desk, and she's literally a few doors down from the OMB director. So even though the president, yes, is not involved there every time a regulation goes through OIRA, if she takes a position that turns out to be not the right one according to the person who got elected by everyone in this country, she will answer for that very quickly and in a very acute way, and even in lesser examples with the OMB director. So there's real political accountability there, and the OIRA administrator understands and has to be very sensitive to the president's philosophy on regulatory matters, or they may not last very long.
Yeah, I'll quickly say it's interesting that the proposal, you know, some of the same people that have argued that OIRA should not have the authority to basically countermand the agencies with regard to rulemaking are now advocating that OIRA should be setting the priorities for the agencies and establishing their agendas. How do you simultaneously hold that position? If it's wrong for them to countermand the agencies, how do you argue that they have the statute, the authority under the statute to help set their agendas? I don't understand that. CPR members have.
I agree with Curtis's point. I would also say that You do not have to talk to the president to know where he stands on a certain issue. The first regulation that came across my desk was one from the D.C. Parole Board that would ban abortions in women who were paroled from the D.C. system. I didn't need to talk to him to know that he was pro-choice.
I don't think it's inconsistent to say that at the same time, in my view, OIRA ought to back off from things which it's not particularly good at and which is not as appropriate for it to do, the nitpicky stuff, but on the other hand, to be more proactive in looking broadly across government and then shining a light on agencies and saying there are things that you need to do that you're not doing. And I think the prompt letters were a quantum leap above the previous administration. I know Sally in her Michigan Law Review article said that the agencies were so active and zealous in that time they didn't need prompting. Not where I was, not at CPSC. We could have used some prompting. The problem with the Bush era prompt letters was that the very few of them that did actually ask for new rules, like the defibrillator one that went to OSHA, there was no follow-up, and the agency was allowed to thumb its nose at OIRA, and I think that speaks to the need for more. If it's going to be a heavy hand against inaction, I think is what's needed right now.
When somebody said that Sally was across the street from the president, I was thinking, yeah, and I can see Russia from my house. But I'll end on that.
Yeah, how can you do better? I'd like to thank our panelists for a great presentation. We have about a 12-minute break.